Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, I continue my 9-year anniversary special with part 2. This is 9 more of my very favorite stories over the last 9 years, including stories from legendary broadcaster Larry King, comedian and filmmaker Bobcat Goldthwait, comedian Esther Koo, comedian Michael Costa, author Charles Freericks, writer David Wilde, comedian Mindy Rickles, actor Jim Beaver, and comedian Randy Sklar. Stick around. This is a good one, guys. Hey, it's Christine Blackburn, and you're listening to Storyworthy. Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. Now, I hope you guys enjoyed the show last week, which was my anniversary special part 1. I highlighted 9 of my favorite stories over the last 9 years, and today is part 2, and I'm going to highlight 9 more stories. I mean, honestly, you guys, it was hard to get it down to 18 stories, obviously. I mean, I have recorded over 567 episodes of Storyworthy, so getting it down to 18 has not been easy, and I guarantee you, every story you're about to hear is well worth it. By the way, if you want to hear the full episode of any of these, of course, you can go back and do that over on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, StoryworthyPodcast.com, you know, wherever you listen to podcasts. And I did want to remind you guys that I just recently kicked up my Patreon page again. If you go over to patreon.com/storyworthy, you'll see the 4 different tiers that you can donate to the show, keep Storyworthy going, and I have different things that I offer to give to you, like free live shows, and also I will help you craft your story. How would you like that? Or if you have a business, I will sponsor you. How would you like that? Again, head over to Patreon. You'll see the different levels. And a big thank you to the people who have subscribed so far, like Jody Roman and Linda Palmer. And I really appreciate your support, you guys. You know, sponsors come and go, but my listeners are, you guys are constant and you're always there. And I see the download numbers and I know you're listening. So this is a great way for you guys to show your support. And thank you so, so much. All right, you guys, we're going to kick things off right away with one of my very favorite people of all time. And that is legendary broadcaster Larry King. Now, if you've been listening to Storyworthy over the last 9 years, you've heard me talk about Larry from time to time. And so last year, for my 8-year anniversary, it was so exciting to get Larry on as a guest of Storyworthy. I went over to his house in Beverly Hills, and we sat down in his dining room, and actually, I think it was the breakfast nook, and we talked for like an hour, and he was so funny and charming, and at one point, one of his sons came downstairs and chatted, and at one point, a housekeeper came in and chatted. And when we were done recording, Larry was like, "Well, I'm sure you'll see your way out." And he took off his headphones and he just kind of left me there. It's kind of cool. Anyway, Larry's health hasn't been that great recently. And I really wish him the best. And I hope he has many, many more years with us. All right, you guys, without further ado, here's Larry King on Storyworthy talking about stand-up comedians.
Hi, this is Larry King, and you're listening to Storyworthy. I don't call work work. I've been doing this interviewing thing for 61 years. I'm going to be 85 in November. My father died when he was 46, and I was 9. I never thought I'd live this long. I've gotten through a lot of illnesses and beat them, which I'm very thankful for. My spare time is spent reading. I do a lot of reading. I love movies. I love theater. I don't love travel so much. Mm-hmm. I mean, I go to New York 4 times a year. We do shows in New York. I still go to do my show every day. I love comedy. If I hadn't become a broadcaster, which I always wanted to do when I was 5 years old, I wanted to be on the radio. It's the truth. I'd have been a comedian. I love stand-up comedy, all the great comics that I've interviewed and spent time with. I love the way comedians think. I tell you, there's nothing in the world to me like telling a joke and coming to the punchline and that moment before the laugh occurs.
Yeah, because you have the power.
When you know you go, oh yeah, you own the stage. You have a lot of power when you're interviewing too, because the good interviewer, it's always in his ballpark. But there's nothing like standing on a bare stage alone. Think of what the stand-up comic does.
Mm-hmm.
Stands on a bare stage, no script, a whole audience. If you're doing drama, you don't know how well you're doing. If you're doing Shakespeare, the audience is quiet. They could be asleep. But if you're doing comedy, people don't fake laughter. I asked Bob Hope once, do you have an edge because you're Bob Hope? When you walk on stage, you're Bob Hope. Do you have an edge over Joe Smith? He says, for about 2 minutes, you better be funny. Lenny Bruce was a great friend of mine. And Lenny, of course, was a giant of comedy. I know he cursed a lot and he took on religion a lot, but Lenny, there was only one Lenny. And I had did a show at this Pumperdick's restaurant in the morning, and Lenny was on with Don Rickles. And Lenny is wearing a prison uniform that he got from Rayford, which is the state prison in Florida. A friend of his smuggled out the uniform. So I said to him, Lenny, why are you wearing a prison uniform? You know, with the number on it and stripes. And he said, I like to wear this. And I like to go up to cops and ask them information about where is this, how do I get certain place. I said, well, why do you like to do that? He said, because I love the look on their faces. The cop thinks, is this an escaped prisoner asking me for directions? Or is this a brilliant escape prisoner who thinks I won't think he's an escape prisoner? Because why would an escape prisoner go up to a cop? So I like to see the things that go through a cop's mind. And Rickles said, Lenny, get a job. Lenny, this is no way to live.
All right, Larry King. If you guys want to hear the full episode of this, of course, like I said, you can go over to storyworthypodcast.com and do that. Or listen at Apple Podcasts, Spotify. You know, the whole catalog is there wherever you go. By the way, Larry King was also on Story Smash before as an expert judge. That was last year, July of 2018. You can look that up as well. It's so funny. Larry on Story Smash, just one of the funniest episodes ever. At one point, his phone rang and he took out a flip phone. So, yeah, it was pretty awesome. All right, you guys, the next story is from comedian and filmmaker Bobcat Goldthwait, and his story is about performing for the Insane Clown Posse Juggalos. He told me this story on August 16th, 2015.
Hi, this is Bobcat Goldthwait. You're listening to Storyworthy. So if you're looking for something else, you should turn this off. So I performed at the Gathering of the Juggalos, and for those people who don't know what the Gathering of the Juggalos is, Insane Clown Posse is a music festival, and I'm using the term music really loosely, and it's really sketchy. I toured as an opening act for Nirvana. I've done gigs. I was the opening act for Nirvana. Comics will often go, oh, you know, talk about heckling. I was hit with a teenager. They successfully threw a teenager out of the pit and it hit me. I'd have M80s going by, blowing off around my head and stuff. Still not as sketchy as the Juggalos because there's no security, there's no lights. It's just kind of like, it's like Mad Max. There's just fires and people selling bath salts, people taking bath salts, and I'm making a general sweeping statement here, but most of the Juggalos are morbidly obese, and they wear clown makeup. It's a incest survivors convention. It's like, no one's going to molest me. I'm a scary clown. So Again, if you haven't been exposed to the Gathering of Juggalos, Google Tila Tequila Gathering of the Juggalos, because when she was performing, the Juggalos like to spray Fago Cola on each other and on the acts, and they ran out of Fago Cola to spray on Tila Tequila, so they knocked over the outhouses and they just grabbed human poo and threw it at her. And I stress human because, like, if it's so much worse. Like, if you and I were walking on the street and you picked up some dog shit and hit me with it, later on we would be friends. I mean, I'd be mad, but we'd laugh it off. I'd be like, dude, that was, why'd you do that? You know, I thought that was funny. But if you picked up some hobo Duke and hit me with it, that would be a deal breaker. I mean, we wouldn't be friends anymore. So I'd be like, great, now I got Hep C in my eye, really swift. So my opening act was a guy named Upchuck the Clown, and Upchuck is driving me around the grounds of the gathering, and he's trying to convince me, you got nothing to worry about, you know, they're going to really love you, you know, it's really chill, it's family, you know, it's like, oh, you know what really made me mad, he said, it's like performing at a Dave Matthews concert, and that made me mad to imply I would go to a Dave Matthews concert. That's what really frosted my cake. So a juggalo breaks free of the herd while we're driving around in this golf cart. And the juggalos were impressed. Like, who are the millionaires? You know, they're in a golf cart. So this juggalo runs alongside of the moving golf cart that Upchuck's driving. He just starts punching him right in the face while he's driving. He's like, fuck you, Upchuck! Fuck you! And he's hitting him really hard in the face. And Upchuck just hits the gas and nervously laughs. I'm here every year, and they know me. And then and then a can of Fago comes whizzing in at about 50 miles an hour and just pops him right in the skull. There's this big, loud pop. And then he was unconscious for a split second. He slumped over the steering wheel. And then he wakes up and he goes, I'm hurt. I'm hurt really bad. And so he goes, steer. So he hits the gas again. And now I'm steering with the semi-unconscious clown slumped over the wheel. And we're weaving in and out of juggalos like it's Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. And then he clearly had a concussion, and I helped him in the dressing room. And seeing that this is broadcast, he may or may not. He did some sort of white powdery beef, to quote Shakes the Clown. I guess it's an old-time remedy, you know, if you had a concussion, you don't want to sleep, you know, feed a fever. So, yeah, it might have been speed, or I don't know what it was, but he's doing some sort of powder. So that is, you may want to edit that out. That could be slightly libelous. But, yeah, so I did, it's a sweet gig, Gathering the Juggalos. So I'll be back next year. I'm really looking forward to it. No.
Is that funny or what, you guys? I love Bobcat Goldthwaite, and I absolutely adore that story. All right, you guys, the next story is from comedian Esther Koo, and the title of the story is When You Catch Them Cheating. And boy, oh boy, this story had me on the edge of my seat. It's really well done, and Esther is an excellent storyteller. She really paints a vivid picture. This story first aired on February 25th, 2018. And now you guys enjoy Esther Koo.
And we just never had to talk. I never said, are we exclusive? I just assumed we were exclusive. And I think that's it's an easy thing to kind of fall into that because, you know, I didn't want to be vulnerable to be like, well, I just wanted to believe that we were exclusive, and I never really put myself out there by making him say to me, we are exclusive. So we're hooking up and, you know, we're getting along and I like him a lot. And then we just keep seeing each other like month after month after month. Maybe I don't even remember because I was just smoking a lot of weed and I just forgot how much time went by. So it could be anywhere from 6 to 12 months that went by. Wow. That we're seeing each other on a regular basis, right? And then just one day, I was like, you know, as a comedian, every Monday or Tuesday night, it can also feel like a Saturday or Sunday. So I never realized that I never see him on weekends until like several months in. Then I'm thinking, oh, you know, it's weird. I never see, because I'm always doing shows on Friday, Saturday anyway. So I never really needed to see him on weekends because I was busy. So one day though, I was like, oh, I think I don't ever see him on weekends. That's weird. And I was thinking maybe he's like seeing somebody else. So I just started like getting kind of like curious, like, is he? But I didn't have the balls to say, are you seeing somebody else? You know, am I exclusive? I just wanted to believe that I was. So I never brought it up. Right. So then I one day I was at his apartment and I would sleep over all the time. And he was like, I'm going to go. I got to go to work, but you can sleep in. You know, I know you stayed out late and you can sleep in and just let yourself out. So while he went to work, I took the keys to his apartment and I went to the hardware store and I made a copy so that I could investigate, like, is he seeing someone else? To me, it was easier to do that than to, like, ask him straight out. So I go to the hardware store around the corner, and there's a hardware store like every three blocks in New York. So it's so easy to make a copy of a guy's keys, right? So I go, I say, I need a copy of each of these keys. So there's like the front door, then there's the, you know, the apartment door. So I think I got two keys made or something. I held onto those keys for like another 2 or 3 months. And every time I was in his neighborhood, like doing a show, I'd like be like, oh, I want to see what's going on. You know, I kind of wanted like just barge in and be like, and just, you know, I wonder what's going on, but I'll do it another day. And then one day I just like mustered up the balls to be like, I'm going to go in there. And so in the middle of the day on like a Tuesday, I just let myself into his apartment and I just stick the key in his apartment door. I unlock it. Then I go inside and there's like a woman's bra on the floor and then like a woman's clothes all over. And I'd never seen women's clothes in his apartment before. So I just thought he was just like kind of like this pathetic single guy. So I'm looking around. And when I had gone in there, I had locked all the doors, locked all the locks behind me. And there's like four locks. It's New York, right? So I locked all of the doors, all the locks. Then I'm looking around the bedroom. All of a sudden, I hear the door like jiggling. Somebody's trying to get in. So I sneak over to the front door. I look through the peephole and I see a woman, this blonde woman, really pretty. She's like trying to like unlock the door, but I had locked the one padlock that there's no key for. You could only like unlock it from the inside. So then I call him and I say, hey, I broke into your apartment, but now somebody else is trying to break into your apartment. And he was like, you're so funny, ha 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 ha. And I literally said to him 5 times, I am not kidding. I broke into your apartment. And he just thought, there's no way. How can I break into his apartment? What am I going to go through the fire escape? It's on the third floor, you know? And it, his apartment's secure. There's locks. So he's like, you're so funny. I'm like, I'm not fucking kidding. I'm in your bathroom and there's this blonde woman trying to break into your apartment now. You got to help me. And he goes, you really did it. I go, what? He goes, that's my wife.
Is that a great story or what? Holy cow, man. She had me on the edge of my seat. Oh my gosh, just fantastic. Go back, listen to the whole episode of Esther Koo. It's from February 2018. Okay, you guys, here comes another great story. And this one is from comedian, and now he's a regular over there on The Daily Show, and it's Michael Costa. And he is telling a story about his first professional tennis tournament.
Hey, everybody, and this is Michael Costa. You're listening to Storyworthy. In tennis, just like life, love means nothing. My last collegiate tennis tournament was in Lubbock, Texas, at the NCAA Championships for Texas A&M. There was about, I don't know, maybe 900 to 1,000 people watching. This is pretty good for collegiate tennis. 1,000 people watching is pretty good. I lost very badly in my last collegiate tennis match to USC, of all places. And now I live in Los Angeles, USC. This guy kicked my ass. I'll never forget his name. I'm not going to mention it because I don't even want to give him the respect. I'll never forget walking into that last match of mine that I was about to lose. And there was a sign only in Texas at the tennis center that said, no handguns. And it always just made me laugh. Tennis is not a handgun sport, but only in Texas does it say no handguns. So I walked in, I saw no handguns, and I lost badly. The next day, I flew I was done with college. I graduated with a communications degree. Who knows what the hell that means? And I was out of tennis. I graduated. I flew to Zihuatanejo, Mexico for my very first professional tennis tournament with my doubles partner, Nathan Zeter. Why does Zihuatanejo, Mexico sound familiar? That's where Andy Dufresne escaped prison to in The Shawshank Redemption. It's a real city. It's a real place. That was my very first professional tournament. We land. We immediately go to the hotel. Okay, it's a nice hotel. It's a resort hotel, and it's $150 a night. This is Mexico. Nothing should be $150 ever. I'm now paying my own fare. It's not like the University of Illinois is paying for me. This was a big problem. Immediately we land. We go, I can't pay $150 a night. Meanwhile, if you win the tournament we're playing, you make $3,000. Okay, so this is like to go 7 nights in a hotel, you basically wipe out your prize money. We go to the practice courts, and we notice that it's just a sheet of asphalt. There are no lines down. There's a fat Mexican man with a brush painting the tennis lines. Now, this is not how you paint tennis lines. It's normally like a laser in a fucking cart that you push or something. It's a fat Mexican guy painting the lines. And I go, you know, this is a little different than being in Lubbock, Texas 2 days ago with a multi-million dollar facility, no handguns permitted. That night, we go to sleep. Air conditioning, $150 a night. It was great. I slept well. And I remember thinking, this is it. Tomorrow's my professional tennis debut. Show up to the match the next morning. The umpire has a coin the size of a Frisbee. Okay. And he flips the coin. Before a tennis match, you flip a coin and you say, if you call it right, you can either serve, you can receive, or you can defer the decision. So this guy has this fucking giant coin. And I go, hey, man, why is your coin so big? And the umpire goes, well, I don't have great eyesight. Now, this is going to be my umpire who's calling all the lines for this match. I lose my match. I don't even remember the match. I remember losing. And there were these two Mexican men who, from the beginning of the match to the end of the match, were watching my match. And they were kind of cheering occasionally, and they would clap or whatever. And I lost. When you lose first round of a minor league professional tennis tournament, I made $91. Not bad. And I remember I lost. I felt kind of bummed, but I knew, you know, there's another match, another tournament coming up. And I went over to those two men, and I said, hey, you know, thanks for watching. 3 days ago, I was playing in front of 1,000 people. Now I'm playing in front of two Mexicans. I go, thanks for watching, guys. And they said, no, we just have the court after you. So it was definitely welcome to the pro tour. Go back to the hotel. No way I can afford a $150 night hotel when I just lost. If I'd kept winning, then you can stay in the nice hotel. But this is what happens when you are not a great tennis player. When you lose, you got to switch hotels. So Nathan lost as well. Nathan and I switched to a $9 a night hotel deep downtown Zihuatanejo. Our broken Spanish, very, very hot. It was probably 140 degrees. We would take freezing cold showers and then run into bed and try to fall asleep before we started sweating. And we were still in doubles. So we did okay in doubles. We made second round, third round. We maybe made like $70 or something. But we're in this $9 a night hotel, truly $9 a night. And I remember after I lost my match, Nathan and I were like, the tournament is over. This is our first professional tournament. Even though we sucked and we lost, we deserve to go out and celebrate. So even though we lost, this is probably why I didn't do great on the professional tennis tour. I lost, and yet we were still celebrating. So we go to this awesome little taco joint. I drank a strawberry margarita. Nathan was smart and had a beer. And we're kind of sitting there, and we're talking, and we're reminiscing about the week. And we go, you know, this is going to be hard. We didn't realize how difficult it was going to be. We in college, everything is paid for. You have a clothing sponsor. You have rackets. You have guys that string your rackets. You have people that book your flights. This was our awakening to this is actually going to be difficult. And we weren't sad. We weren't depressed. But we just looked ahead. It was a time in our lives where we looked forward and we go, this is going to be fucking hard. And I remember as we were walking away, my stomach started to kind of gurgle. And Nathan goes, did you have a strawberry margarita? And I go, yeah. And he goes, you know, it has ice in it, right? So for the next 3 days, Montezuma's revenge, diarrhea. And I remember just going to bed that night with diarrhea, pissing out of my ass, going, what the hell just happened, man? I'm playing a professional tennis tournament, and now I have diarrhea, and I'm in Zihuatanejo, Mexico. And ladies and gentlemen, that's my first professional tennis tournament.
Is that fascinating or what? I absolutely love that story. I love the trajectory of the hotels that you stay in, whether you're winning or losing. And I love those guys who are waiting to use the court and they thought they were fans. Just unbelievable. Anyway, I adore tennis and I adore Michael Costa. So that I found a perfect story. All right, you guys, this next story is from writer Charles Freericks. And the title of the story is Stalker. And I have to tell you, this is a riveting story. Just amazing. I don't need to say anything else about it. You guys just can take a listen. It's from January 20th, 2014.
A brand new 2004 Jaguar X-Type ripped down 4th Street at what must have been 50 miles an hour. There were three-year-olds feet away. This was a street my own five-year-old and seven-year-old walked on. This was my neighborhood, and I was responsible for keeping it safe. I was a little out of breath from climbing the grade, but was still able to work up a really irritated face and strong head shake at the passing little fake Jaguar. The driver, a ginger yuppie with pasty white skin and a way too big forehead, stared back at me as he passed. I wish I'd done more, screamed, given him the finger, hocked a loogie on his windshield, but it was too late. He and his ersatz Jaguar were gone. Now, you may be wondering why I called it a fake Jaguar. Well, the Jaguar X-Type was a brief mistake from the early 2000s, wanting to compete with BMW, but with no existing platform to build a smaller car on, Jaguar turned to its then corporate parent Ford to provide them with that platform. The end result, one might say, was Jaguar's Edsel, New Coke, or Netflix Quickster. Built on the same platform as the Ford Contour, a car I'm guessing even most car aficionados no longer remember, but which can best be described as a Ford Taurus that had been left in the dryer too long. The Jaguar X-Type was nothing more than a tarted up, emaciated Taurus with a Jaguar grill and headlight treatment, sort of like when someone puts a Mercedes hood ornament on their Dodge Neon. But back on that day I'm describing, it was still a brand new Jaguar, priced the same as a BMW or a Mercedes, and certainly worthy of purchase by an upcoming yuppie in a men's warehouse sports coat and tie. And it's in that perceived automotive entitlement that my bad situation spun into what I would call a terrible one. You see, as I neared the next block, the Jaguar X-Type in question roared back up fourth, up the grade, tore past me, and pulled to a stop at the cross street that I was approaching. The driver's side window came down halfway, and the ginger yuppie yelled out, "Do you have a problem?" The correct answer to his question would have been, "Actually, sir, this is a residential street and with a preschool on the corner, and it's really not safe for the kids when folks exceed the speed limit." The answer probably would have gotten me cursed out. It may have resulted in a spit out, "I'll drive how I want." It doubtless would have resulted in my not ever seeing the ginger yuppie with the fake Jaguar again. But I'll never know because I didn't do that. No, I figured I was fit. I just climbed the grade, and I was dealing with an asshole who needed to be put in his place. I decided that what I should do was insult him. "You're driving a Ford," I began. "Huh?" he responded. "Your car. It's a Ford Detour with a Jaguar grill pasted on," I continued, as I briskly walked past him and back up the sidewalk towards home. As I neared the next block, the little fake Jaguar pulled up at the cross street. It was then that for the first time since I'd started working out and losing weight, that the reality that while I may have been in much better physical shape than I had been 6 months earlier, I was also not as strong as I had been when I was huskier, came to me. Yes, I had more muscle tone on my arms, but I didn't have that extra 35 pounds behind them anymore. I was weak. While I was thinking about this ironic and inopportune truism, the ginger yuppie got out of his car and waited for me on the lawn of an apartment building. It was then that I realized that he probably did not get his sports coat at Men's Warehouse, but rather Rochester Big and Tall. He was a minimum of 6'7" tall, and while not overweight, was solid. He was smiling, while I, like an idiot, continued to walk towards him. I found his smile oddly comforting, as if he was waiting for me to say, "You got me on the Jag. It's really a Ford. Good one." Unfortunately, as it turned out, he was in point of fact smiling that big, beautiful grin because he was simply a fucking psychotic. I thought I might just walk past him, but he got right in front of me. Being 6'2 and a half myself, I understand that physical size can be very intimidating. I just wasn't used to being the one intimidated. I actually tried to keep walking, brushing him aside. "You think you're funny?" he said as he shoved me back. It wasn't an overly aggressive shove, but it also confirmed my sense that he was a great deal stronger than I was, and if this was going to turn into a physical battle, the best I could hope for was to limit the amount of ribs I had broken. All of the things that I thought made me win in the situation, the fact that I owned a better car, the fact that I was a studio executive, the fact that this was my hood, the fact that I was not an idiot who would chase someone down for shaking their head at me didn't matter. None of that made a difference. So I decided my best bet was to apologize with a slightly toadishy grovel. It was frankly the only arrow in my quiver. Before I could verbally prostrate myself, however, I got shoved again. I stood my ground so that it wouldn't give him the pleasure of knowing that I was petrified by his amazing shoving skills. "You have a problem?" he asked. "No," I answered, a hell of a lot less cocksure than I had been when he was still in his car. "There are a lot of crazies out there," he went on. "I'm one of them, but there are people even crazier than me. One of those guys is going to kill you. Maybe it'll be me. So let me ask, do you want to apologize?" I didn't feel it prudent to point out that he was actually contradicting himself within his own threat. "Yes, I apologize," I said. While my insides churned, I took solace in the fact that I knew I was lying. It was admittedly not much, but frankly, I live off crumbs. Unfortunately, the apology wasn't sufficient for the supersized howdy-doody. For the next hour or 2.5 minutes, I'm not certain, I stood there wondering if I was about to die because I'd gotten fit. Meanwhile, he prattled on about the insane people in the world and how lucky I was that I'd run across him, who was frankly only slightly insane. He made me apologize another 5 times, each time chipping away another piece of my soul. I had no idea if I was going to get the hell beaten out of me or if I was going to be beaten to death until he finally relaxed his shoulders and sighed, as if he felt he had made his point. Then he shoved me one last time and walked back to his car. Now, the entire thing would probably have been over then. But I was angry and shamed at the same time, or what is known as the cocktail of stupid blunder still to come. And sure enough, I made one. As he walked back to his car, I followed to get a good look at his license plate number. He saw this and for the first time looked concerned, worried, and even alarmed that maybe he was the one who had made the mistake. "I will find out where you live and kill you in front of your family," he said.
Holy shit, right? I know. Amazing. All right, you guys, the next story is coming at you from David Wilde. David Wilde is a writer, and he also is a producer, and he puts together a lot of concerts, like benefits, you know, like the benefit for the 9/11 victims, or the benefit for Whitney Houston, or something like that, or the Grammys, different huge events. Anyway, super interesting guy, and David tells a story about Van Morrison that I had no idea this would be Van Morrison. It was just so interesting. So anyway, the title of the story is My Bad Moon Dance, and I know you're going to love it. It's from November 16th, 2015.
Hi, this is David Wilde, and I've always wanted to be story-worthy. It's 1990. I'm the music editor of Rolling Stone magazine. I am 27, something like that, and arrogant, you know, with the job, because the internet hasn't come around and destroyed journalism. Being the music editor of Rolling Stone is actually an amazingly privileged position for any age, but definitely at my age, I was just not that long out of college, and I just had this crazy early luck in my career. It went to crap later. But I'm sitting in my office one day, and I get a call from Van Morrison's record company. Van had not done an interview with Rolling Stone or pretty much anybody for years. In particular, he hated Rolling Stone because, in his opinion, there had been an article that had begun with a lead that gave directions to his house. And he didn't like that, which made sense, but I don't think the article actually gave directions to his house. But I get the call saying Van has agreed to do an interview with Rolling Stone for his new greatest hits record, and he'll only do it with you, David Wilde. And I was even more – I went to 5'7", based on the short joke. I felt up from 5'6". And I was thrilled. So then what proceeded to happen was, in journalistic terms, like Vietnam. I spent the next few weeks being told, okay, he wants you to fly to Dublin. And then they'd cancel. We'd get plane tickets. Then it was come out to L.A., cancel. Finally, I'm told, okay, Van can't wait to see you, and he will see you at the David Letterman show. He wants to really just get to know you a little bit at the David Letterman show, which then was on air. This is all those years ago. And I came down to the Letterman show, and this manager, right before he's about to introduce me to Van Morrison, says, okay, here's the deal. I'm going to tell him I went to high school with you. Just go along with that. And I went, what? And then Van comes off stage and he goes, Van, this is my friend David from high school. And Van looked at me, ran the other way, and that was my introduction to Van Morrison. And I was like, what the fuck just happened? And so that was the beginning. Then I got a call going, oh, Van was really so happy to meet you. He really wants you to come to Boston. And I flew to Boston, checked into a great hotel because journalism in those days could pay for great hotels. Mm-hmm. So I think I was on the Four Seasons or something like that. And I'm there for the first show, for the second show, for a third show, for a fourth show. I'm seeing great shows. I'm seeing okay shows. But I'm not talking to Van Morrison. And I'm running up a tremendous amount of expense for Rolling Stone, which could sustain it. But I have nothing to show for it. Finally, it's the last show. And I go to the manager and I go, I'm leaving town. This is ridiculous. He goes, no. After the show tonight, he's going to have fans having a party at the Hard Rock Cafe. How cool was that? he goes, you come to the party and we're going to talk. Van's going to talk to you after that. I go to the party and Van is standing by himself over a chafing dish, inhaling chicken wings and egg rolls and grease. There's no napkins anywhere. He's just like it was like he was like a starving man at a bar mitzvah. It was just I don't know what was going on. And that was the moment where the manager said, Van, this is David Wilde, who you're going to talk to. Van started to shake my hand. And when I say start, I mean we went up in the shake, but before it could go down, and I already have egg rolls and chicken wings in my hand, he darts into the hallway, runs away from me, mid-shake. And I see him, and he's sitting with standing in the hallway with Georgie Fame, who's a legendary sort of keyboardist and British musician who was in his band at the time. And I'm like, what just happened? And the manager goes, don't worry. Here's what you do. Just go out in the hall, walk back in front of Van for a little while, let him get comfortable with you. And I went, what do you mean? Should I lift my hind leg and see if Van wants to mount me? I don't know what, like, this is not usually how interviews go. This is, so I actually did it. I went in the hall, walking back in front, parading in front of Georgie Fame and Van Morrison. Georgie looked confused. Van looked utterly disinterested. And I said, fuck this, I'm going. And I went to the manager and I said, okay, I'm leaving. This is absurd. At which point, thank God, I guess, Peter Wolf of the Jay Giles Band, the front man of the Jay Giles Band, was at this party. He was the only person at the party besides the band. And I knew Pete from The Office. He'd been around. He's a friend of Jan Wenner's. And I explained what was going on. And for those, a little deep rock history, Peter Wolf was a DJ before he was like a rock star in Boston around the time that Van was of Astral Weeks and Van spent some time in Boston. So I told him what was going on. He goes, oh, I'll fix this. I thought that was going to be easy. But he did. He walked over to Van. They talked for a few minutes and he came back. And he went, all right, we'll have lunch then. And that was progress. That was – so the next day I didn't check out. I didn't go home. And the next day we literally reserved – we found out what Van's favorite restaurant in Cambridge was. We reserved the back room of the restaurant. We briefed the staff on not to look at him, not to talk to him. We had Matt Mahurin, who was a world-famous photographer. You know, he had just done the album cover for Tracy Chapman's record. If you think of that, he's a great photographer. He was supposed to do a session with Van. He was being blown off too. So they arranged for him to be in the corner of the room, like hidden behind a curtain, so that he could try to take a picture of Van talking to me to document that this hell was really happening. So I sat there and I was kind of a little bit more into preparing then for things. And I had a list of maybe 200 questions.
Oh, my God.
I was ready. It was a career retrospective, the Rolling Stone interview, which is like your life story. Yeah. So I started to ask My first question, I looked up and Van was running out of the restaurant.
Is that wild or what? I know, right? So interesting. Don't forget, you guys, head over to my Patreon page, patreon.com/storyworthy, and support the podcast. I would super appreciate it. At the $20 a month level, I will help you form your story. Yeah, that's right. I'll create a Google Doc, and we'll go back and forth until you have the perfect story. And let me tell you, I'm very good at this. I have a little bit of experience. So consider that. Or if you'd like free tickets to my shows, you can support at the $10 level, and I'll give you free tickets. How about that? Anyway, you guys, check it out, patreon.com/storyworthy. Okay, three more stories left in my anniversary special part two. This next story is from comedian Mindy Rickles, and the title of the story is Embarrassed, and you'll soon find out why she was embarrassed, and it's just such a funny story, and she's just a funny, funny girl. And I think you're really going to enjoy it. Okay, this is from September 11th, 2017.
So I went to the store. I wasn't thrilled about this. And I got, and they're so glamorous, you know, adult diapers. And it wasn't pleasant. I put on the diaper. You know, it's not uncomfortable. But, you know, your ass, it gets very Kardashian-like with the cushy and the, you know, there's a lot of dimpling and all this. And it's not a great feeling. So anyway, I started walking around in the diaper because I was worried all the time that I could have an explosion. You know, God knows where. I could be on stage and have an explosion. So that was not a good thing. So anyway, I used to, you know, during the day, and like you said, it's Malibu and it's LA, so I'm not a person that really is into exercise in any way, shape, or form. I do it a little, but I always want to look like I'm exercising. I always wear workout clothes every day. So people think, you know, she's a trainer, but why she has all that back fat, we're not sure. So I wear, you know, biking pants and a t-shirt. Like, oh, I just came from the gym, and God, I'm on my way to my yoga and the Bikram sweating, you know, whatever, safari class that I'm doing. And I teach, when I'm not home, I teach, which, you know, if you saw me, you would be, because I literally, you know, if you sent me to a yoga class, my neck and my boobs would be, like, attached, and my left foot would be around my neck, and then I have a hump on my back, so that would be hanging over. So I don't love yoga. But anyway, so I always wear the workout clothes. So my son goes to this private school. You know, it's like one of these fancy private schools, just because I think it makes me look good to people. Like, oh, she does well because her son goes to this school. So anyway, my son was in this play at the school. Actually, it was Shrek, and they had rehearsals, you know, like they were going to Broadway. So they had rehearsals for like 15 months, you know, 17 hours a day, because, you know, they're all going to be stars one day. You know, and you love when the ones that are really bad, like they say, the sun and the sky. Oh, he's wonderful. What a singer. You know, when parents do that about their kids. But no, this was a good show. But anyway, I had to pick him up every day, and he was, you know, a senior. And I had to pick him up every day after these rehearsals, you know, after these three-hour rehearsals. So sometimes it'd be like at 5 o'clock. I would get there maybe a little bit early, and I would sit in the parking lot and wait. So one day I went, and I got on the phone, on my phone in the car, to a very close girlfriend of mine. We were just going to chat. You know, I had her on speakerphone. Now, as I'm chatting with her, this guy pulls up. Now, he's a dad at the school that I've known for years. And he's actually a very, very successful male model. And he's not a kid. You know, he's older. He's like a Pierce Brosnan type. Or if that most interesting man in the world were good looking, he's like that. And so I said to Sophie, and whenever I see him through the years, I admit I get flustered because he's so handsome and he's so charming and elegant and all this. So now I'll preface this by saying he hadn't seen me in a couple of years because we left the school and I had lost some weight, because at one point I decided, you know what, let me just blow up like a balloon and gain 20 pounds just for fun. So by this time, though, I'd lost the weight, and he hadn't seen me in a couple of years. But, you know, I go to the school to pick up my son. I'm wearing, you know, my workout pants and a t-shirt like I always do. I got that diaper on. You know, it's all padded and gushy, but it's there. And then I'm wearing no makeup, and I'm wearing big sunglasses and like a floppy hat. So, you know, because I'm very well known, I don't want anyone to recognize me. And I also look like, you know, one of the Manson girls before they were arrested. So he pulls up next to me, and I'm on the phone with Sophia, my girlfriend, on the speakerphone, and I go, oh, God, here's John, you know, the model. And she knew all about him. I said, oh, you know, he's always like so adorable and looks perfect. And I said, I'm sure I'll just come over the car window and say hi and then get back in his car, even though there's no one there. And like I said, I had the hat on, the glasses, but no makeup in the outfit. So he hadn't seen me in a while. And he comes, he pulls up next to me. And I thought, you know, just be like, hi, Mindy. He's very friendly. But he decides this will be fun to get out of the car and like rest his head on the passenger window, you know, like, I don't know, Mr. Rogers giving me a morning greeting, like really in the car basically with me. Now, my girlfriend is on the speakerphone and she knows all about him. And she's always like a roll your eyes. Like if I say, you know, Sophia, I just performed at Carnegie Hall to 7,000 people and they were screaming with laughter. She'd be like, I'm thrilled. Like that. Like she doesn't really care that much. So anyway, he comes over the car. Now, I have her on the speakerphone because I said, oh, well, here he comes. So I said, don't say anything. So he comes over and he like places his head on the window and he goes, hi, how are you? And then he goes, oh, my God. Now, he hasn't seen me in a while since I lost the weight. You look incredible. Are you not the sexiest? And he's married, you know, but are you not the sexiest thing I've ever seen? You are so hot. And I like want to press my finger on my ass like, I'm hot, you know, and I'm wearing the adult diaper. And he's like, you look sexy as hell. And you are gorgeous. Now, I'm getting like sweating profusely and flustered. I'm like, oh, John, stop it. John, please, you're embarrassing me. No, I can't. I mean, I don't even know what to say. You're the hottest thing I've ever seen. I'm like, John, please, I'm so old. You look like you're 20 years younger. I can't say. Now, Sophia is on the speakerphone and I'm sweating and I'm like, John, stop it. And I'm worried that Sophia's going to like cough or go, is this about it? Can we, you know, and I don't want him to know that she's there. It's mortifying. Like, oh, like I'm 16 and you're listening in with me with the supermodel. So I just decide at this point, you know, I'm so flustered. My fingers are clammy. I just press, you know, the off button and just take her off. So I've hung up on her and I'm thinking, don't even call back at this point. So he's going on and I'm like, oh, stop it, John. And it's still, we got like half an hour before these kids come out. Now I'm wearing the diaper. So now I'm nervous, right? And I don't have much control of my bowels. And he's telling me I'm sexy and hot. And meantime, I'm like a paraplegic, which I love paraplegics. But, you know, sexy isn't the first thing you think of. And I said, oh, yeah, you know, I've been feeling great, whatever. And at this point, I'm so flustered, I'm really worried that I may have an explosion of my bowels because I'm so nervous to be with him. And I'm like, please, God, just don't crap the pants. Just don't do that while he's talking to me and I'm so sexy and wonderful. So my purse is sitting next to me. It's a very large open bag. And, you know, I felt every day that I wore the diaper, better keep a second one handy just in case I'm out somewhere, I have an explosion, and I need to change my diaper. You know, I can't put myself in the restroom at the gas station, get on that little kid's pad that they put and powder myself down. You know, I got to have that other diaper ready to go. So I was keeping it in my purse all the time, but, you know, nobody's looking in my purse. It's a large, very large diaper. So all of a sudden, the kids come out of the rehearsal. And John, like I said, he's a funny guy, whatever. And the kids, they're 17 at the time, they love him. And he all of a sudden thinks it would be really funny. He has no idea what's in my purse. To grab my purse, like, haha, I'm stealing your purse, and run across the parking lot with it. So the kids will be like, oh, he's so funny. And look, haha, he stole Mindy's purse. So he grabs my purse. I'm trying to control my bowels. I'm tightening my anus as much as possible. It's like I never did that. Not Heimlich. What's it called? The other thing where you tighten your ass when you meditate. I forgot. Look, I called it Heimlich. A Heimlich maneuver in my ass. Okay, that's menopause. So I'm trying to do a Heimlich. You know what I'm talking about, whatever that Kankle? Thing is. Kankle? Or Kankles? Kankle. I have Kankles on my ankles. Kegel. Okay, so Kegel. I'm calling it a Heimlich on the ass. It's Kegels. I'm trying to do a Kegel, which I never did because you heard before yoga, I'm horrible, and the hump doesn't help. So I'm trying to just tighten that ass because I think I'm going to have an explosion or, God forbid, a nice big fart right then in front of him, and I'll be mortified. So he grabs the bag, lifts it out of the car, and starts running across the parking lot. And I'm looking at him like, I want to kill myself right now. Put me back in the camps. I know that's inappropriate, but I was just like, this is so horrific. I'm so mortified. There's a huge diaper right at the top of that. I'm like, he's going to run across that yard. The diaper's going to fall out. all these cute 17-year-old kids are going to be like, what the hell is that? His illusion of me being, you know, his Cindy Crawford at 90 years old is going to be gone. And I'm going to look at him and what am I going to say? Oh, that's my mom's. You know, I don't have an answer for him.
Is she funny or what? I know, right? I love Mindy Rickles. She's a comedian, as you know, and she plays around Los Angeles a lot. So if you're ever in LA, catch Mindy Rickles. Super funny girl. All right, you guys, the next story is coming to us from actor Jim Beaver. And this is a beautiful, beautiful story. And the title is Grief. It's about his late wife, Ceci. And it's sad, but it's also very beautiful. It's from June 25th, 2012. Here he is, guys, Jim Beaver.
This is Jim Beaver from Deadwood. And you cocksuckers are listening to Storyworthy. Crack. It's the sound a rocking chair makes when one of the rockers breaks off. It's also the title of a short animated film made in 1980, which won the Academy Award for Best Animated Short Film in 1981. Cecily and I stumbled across the 15-minute film years ago when it was used as filler on the late lamented Z Channel in L.A. Crack tells the story of a French-Canadian family from pioneer days through the modern industrial era, all through the eyes of a rocking chair made by hand by the patriarch of the family. The father has carved a face in the crest rail, and with smiles or frowns, the chair watches all that goes on around it. Children are born, and they are rocked in their mother's arms in the chair. As they grow, they use it as a plaything, their imaginations metamorphosing the chair into a sleigh, a fort, a locomotive, whatever their little minds can conjure. At night, the family sits around the fire, lost in individual reverie, huddled near father as he rocks and smokes his pipe. Seasons pass, children grow and wed. At a wedding dance, the old ladies rock in the chair and watch the young folks celebrate. And when the chair is old and rickety, just like the man who made it, finally one of its rockers breaks. Crack! Yet there's life in and for the old chair, and though the world around the rocking chair transforms with the passing years into something not so pretty or bucolic or likely to render tender memories, eventually the life that the chair has seen, the glories and warmth and security of family and love and community, find their revival, and the resonance of the brief story lingers long, long afterward. Something about this little movie touched me and Cecily deeply. The joys of family love and tradition that she longed so for in her life were beautifully presented in Crack. The music, French-Canadian folk-type music, was redolent of a quieter, more peaceful, and communal time. The detail of the animation, the quirks in the chair's little face, the subtle shifts of mood made this one of the most treasured experiences Cess and I had together. We saw it many times on the grainy videotape I'd made of it, accidentally captured at the tail end of some movie in the mid-80s. Eventually, I found it on DVD, and we saw it again, this time with new appreciation for the artistry and color. I am certain that in all the many times we saw this little film, there was not one time that Cess didn't turn to me afterward and slowly dissolve into tears. Everything she ever wanted in her life was somehow literally or figuratively captured in this little strip of animation. The continuum of love and family, the resonance of happy times that she always believed lingered inside inanimate objects, the traditions of shared, affectionate life that she so hoped to create in her own world, all of it was there. She cried with happiness and longing and with sadness, too, every single time she saw it. We discovered this little film a few months before we got married. When we came home from our wedding, sitting in the middle of our living room was a richly dark cherry wood rocking chair with spindle stiles and a crest rail broad enough to carve a face in. In our 19 years together, Cecily gave me many, many gifts that took my breath away and left me in tears. I think in all our nearly two decades, this rocking chair was the only time I ever really returned the favor. She knew instantly what it was, what it represented. I don't think I ever saw her cry harder for joy. Tonight, as I lay with Maddie, listening to her drift snufflingly off to sleep, I began thinking of videos that Maddie might enjoy, now that she's near to outgrowing some of her favorites. I remembered the DVD with Crack on it, and I wondered how long it would be before Maddie could appreciate that film in something like the way her mother had. And of course, then I began thinking about the film itself, and its depiction of a young husband and wife starting their lives together, having their family and building their home, and growing old together with such love and tenderness for one another and such interdependence, such shared support as their hair grew white and their paces slowed. And I thought of how much Sess wanted that, and how much I wanted it with her, and how difficult it is to imagine growing old without her, how unutterably sad it is to walk that road alone without the one who made my soul sing. Crack. It's the sound a heart makes.
Isn't that beautiful? You guys can go over to YouTube and download that short film, you guys. It's called Crack, C-R-A-C, exclamation point. And it is absolutely beautiful. It's from 1981. Yeah, check that out for sure. And look for Jim Beaver. He's everywhere. Just such an accomplished actor and just a really good person. Okay, you guys, the final story today in my favorite 9 stories of the last 9 years, part 2, is from comedian Randy Sklar. When Randy told me this story, I laughed the whole way through. It's just a silly, funny story about him trying to plan a trip for he and his wife's first anniversary. And you would think it wouldn't be that hard, but boy, if anything could go wrong, it did. So you guys, listen to Randy Sklar and his story, Planning a Trip, from June 26th, 2017.
I said, honey, let's go. I booked us on a hot air balloon ride. She's like, you know I'm afraid of heights. I said, I do now. But why not? Let's try it. Let's overcome our fear of heights. We went to the next morning to the, like, I think it was the Alexander Valley, which is kind of up near Napa, 20 miles north, which is where we should have stayed. We drive up at like 6 in the morning. That's another great thing to do, is force your partner to wake up at 6 in the morning on a vacation. Like, here, I know you're not working, but let's wake up at 5:45 when we should be relaxing. I just did not plan this at all. We get out there, we get to the thing, and she's really scared. I mean, you're watching the balloons get blown up, and she's super nervous because you're standing in a basket that comes up to just below your armpits, and this is not a feeling of, it's loud, but there's not a feeling of like, I'm, that's the thing's like keeping you from just falling out of this thing. It just, there is a definite, if you're afraid of heights, it goes to the core of everything. You're standing in a basket. You feel like, oh, this thing could rip open at any moment. All right, so we get in there, and it's us, some weird German couple, guy with shorts and black socks on, there are like a few other people in our basket, and we get up in the air, and our pilot, okay, the guy, I guess that's what he was called, his name, he called himself Maverick. Now, I mean, it's a reference to Top Gun. I was like, this guy is definitely reckless. I look down at his hand, and the hand that is controlling the thing that has the fire up in the top that goes up in the balloon, he's missing 2.5 fingers. Okay, so I'm like, he's either incredibly unlucky or incredibly reckless and stupid. And his name is Maverick. I'm going to choose the second. Okay. His nickname is Maverick. So he immediately, this is what you're supposed to do. Go 1 mile up, 1 mile over, come down and have like brunch. It's simple. 1 mile up, no wind, 1 mile over. Then you go down and land it at the place you're supposed to land it. And then you have a nice lunch and that's it. Yeah. That's it. We get up into the air, and Maverick radios down to, I mean, I'm standing right next to him. He radios down with the nub of his hand, and he's like, he says to the person, I think, I don't even know if the radio was on, but he said, I got a wind, I'm going with it. All right, and so Amy looks at me like, what in the world did you get us into? First the Christian bed and breakfast, and I'm going to curse like crazy up in this balloon because I've got to get it out before I get back to this place. And secondly, this guy is now a crazy man is piloting this balloon. And I'm afraid because I'm looking over the side and I'm like, we're going to go down. So you're supposed to go 1 mile up, 1 mile over, go down and have lunch. This guy with the wind, because he's like, we don't normally get to do this. We go 13 miles into another direction, into airspace that we don't have clearance to be in. Okay. And he's radioing down. We can see the van that's like frantically driving to kind of find out where we need to go and to find out where he's going to land us. He starts radioing down to them. You got to start knocking on doors and see if we can land on people's farmland. I was like, wait a minute. You haven't cleared this, Maverick? What are you doing? He's like, just knock on doors. Nobody will let us do that. He said, finally, he's like, it's getting later and later and later. Finally, he said, you know what? I see a little spot between the hill and that house over there. I'm going to take it down right here. I'm like, you see a little spot? What are you talking about? This is how you lost those fingers, you idiot. So he starts to take us down fast. I mean, like way faster than the balloon should just go. Like I said, 1 mile up, 1 mile over, sit down, have brunch. That's not what it is. We're coming in hot. Okay. We are coming in fast. And he's like, okay, listen, when the basket hits, everybody jump, because if you don't do that, it's all going to fall over. I was like, what? What are you talking about? This is supposed to be a pleasant thing that I planned for my 1 year anniversary with my wife. Do you understand, Maverick? We land. It goes like it's coming down, and we're coming in at a fast angle. We all jump. I would contest that the Germans didn't jump enough, all right? But that's, look, I have issues with Germans as a Jew.
You got to hear the end of that story, you guys. Head over to storyworthypodcast.com or Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen to your podcasts, and just go to June 26th, 2017, and you'll see that story from Randy Sklar. All right, you guys, I got to wrap it up. I want to thank you so much for tuning in today. You can always tweet me over on Twitter at Storyworthy and also follow me on Instagram at Storyworthy. And you can also find me on Facebook at Christine Blackburn or Storyworthy. You know, you guys, I'm easy to contact. So if there's somebody you really want to get on the show, somebody you think is Storyworthy, let me know who that is and I'll see if I can get them on the show. And again, you guys, thanks so much for checking out my Patreon page. I really appreciate it, and it will keep me going. Sponsors come and go, but you guys are always there. So really, even $5 a month, I really appreciate it. And again, you guys, on behalf of the very talented storytellers I had on today, Larry King, Bobcat Goldthwait, Esther Koo, Michael Costa, Charles Freericks, David Wild, Mindy Rickles, Jim Beaver, and Randy Sklar, my name is Christine Blackburn, saying, make it a story-worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Story-Worthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.